Our sales enablement. Oh, Jan, I've left school. Let me do my job, okay? So it's
Hello and welcome to episode 129 of Rockstar CMO FM. The M is for marketing and the F is for well, you decide. As you're probably wondering, does the world need another effing marketing podcast? I'm your host, Ian Truscott. I'm no rockstar, but I've picked up a thing or two over the last 20 years on my tour from techie to CMO and trusted advisor. And each week, I chat to the true rockstars, my fabulous guests and chums, and share with you some marketing street knowledge that we hope will inspire your inner rockstar. Come say hello. We are Rockstar CMO on Twitter and LinkedIn, and we are proud members of the Marketing Podcast Network. This episode is recorded on Friday the 26th of August 2022. Thanks for joining us. I hope you've had a good week and you are well, safe and staying as sane as you feel you need to be. On this week's episode, Jeff Clark is back in the marketing studio. Former guest and friend of the show, Irene Naircorn-Kane, has some straight talking advice for CMOs. And we wind down the week in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar with Robert Rose for a cocktail and a marketing thought. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On to our first segment, the Marketing Studio with Jeff Clark, Rockstar CMO advisor and former Forrester Serious Decisions Research Director. This week, we dive into building your team's capabilities. Welcome back, Jeff, to Rockstar CMO, to the Rockstar CMO studio with Jeff Clark.
Hello. Right? Hello from the studio.
I got it right this week. Yay. Yay me. I should give this marketing and branding thing a shot, man. I can remember a tagline. Yeah. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much, mate. And we have to do, let me see. Now, let's admit to the listeners that we're recording this in advance of when, no, yes, we're recording this in advance of when it goes out, because instead of taking a break from us, we're actually going to record some extra episodes so you can take a break, right?
So we can take it. So I can take a break. So you can, and the listeners have to stay tuned.
Yes. So we don't really know what the weather's going to be like in a couple of weeks, so we can't do the weather.
It's going to be cooler than it was. I'll guarantee
yes,
you that.
That's true. There will be some weather for sure. So,
and hopefully some rain on our side. So,
yeah, same here. I mean, it's been really, really dry here. Very unlike us. And I don't know. I mean, the other week I was talking to a guest that had moved from Seattle to London, and I thought it would be a great joke if I said you're swapping the drizzle for Seattle for the drizzle of London. And of course, we haven't any drizzle for months.
And I don't think Seattle's having drizzle either, so it's all getting dumped somewhere else.
Yeah, she's like, what are you talking about? It's been 34 degrees here in Celsius, 100 degrees. It's like, yeah, I know. Bad joke. All right. So So this week, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about an article that you discovered, which kind of highlighted a crisis in marketing talent at the moment. And I had a couple of things in there which we thought were really interesting. And one of those things was why there is this crisis in marketing talent is because we're not developing our teams, right?
Absolutely.
And one of the things you discovered. And there's a dearth of training and development of marketers. And you've been looking into this week. What say you, Jeff?
I'd say that there's a dearth of information about the problem, let alone the problem, or let alone about marketing enablement in general. And the more I dug into it, the more I realized. I mean, there's very little There's very little benchmarking data about what marketing teams would spend on training and enablement. Mm-hmm. There's a plethora, the opposite of the dearth, there's a plethora of information about sales training. I mean, if you Google and search for marketing training, you find sales training. And it's like, okay, well, that's not really what I was looking for. I remember when we did benchmarking work on budgets at Serious Decisions and Forrester, it's like, you know, we never really called out marketing enablement, sales benchmarking. They would call out sales enablement, but we never really called it out. It just kind of like stuck in with the overall, you know, staff and related expenses. But my experience has always been that it's just you don't spend a lot. You don't spend a big portion of your budget. And if you're going to spend 40%, 40, 45% of your budget, sometimes more on your staff, it's like you'd think you could like chisel out 2-3% to put on training. And, one of the questions that, I ask, certainly, you may have an opinion on this, is just like, so why are CMOs so reluctant to make this a priority?
I probably have a few opinions on that, but I was going to ask you, because I mean, you spent that time with Serious Decisions Forrester, and I'm very familiar with the sort of work that you did as a client of Forrester, and it's really interesting, isn't it? Because all of those benchmarking things, we talk about sales training, I'm trying to remember some of those models, nothing really on marketing.
You talk about the money you spend on technology, you talk about the money you spend on data, about the money you spend on programs, and you break programs down into the various types of programs. Yeah. But training enablement, I mean, however you want to term it, is just not, is not really covered. And my experience with, CMOs coming into a role, or, sometimes even myself coming into a senior role, and it's like, they may say, you've got a couple of headcount to hire. And so your focus ends up becoming on okay, I got to hire new people to bring in new skills, as opposed to I've got to do things to upskill the current set of people. And so I think there seems to be a bias against doing the upskilling as opposed to sales, which is like, but gosh, we hired 50 salespeople and they're spread across the world and they're not hitting goals. So therefore we need training. And we may swap out a couple of, headcount for, new people, or try to, hire people with a kind of a different, slightly different skill set. But it's, it doesn't happen in marketing.
No, I think that's interesting, because I think there's a culture of training more in sales, isn't it?
Yes.
If you join a large organization, then there'll be a boot camp. There'll be 6 weeks, 2 weeks, whatever it is. You'll go to headquarters. You'll get immersed in their sales methodology, in their messaging and all that kind of stuff, don't you? And that's the nature of sales. And also, I suspect because there's more of a churn in that part of the business, perhaps, and it's established that in order for somebody to get effective and therefore earning revenue, they need to get training. So therefore there's a return on investment already associated with it, even if it isn't expressed that way. But I think it's really interesting because it came out in that article, didn't it? And I'm increasingly hearing this discussion, in fact, just a couple of weeks ago with a CMO, where CMOs are starting to talk about recruitment and retention. And this is obviously going to be a clear element of that. So why do you think that we in marketing spend so little on enablement?
Well, I think that it's not terribly that the enablement is not terribly well directed. In other words, it's like, so is there a general, it's not really about general upscaling, because that would seem to be, kind of additional, money that's just, it doesn't have a real purpose. And certainly I've been through, with some organizations where it's like, we work with HR and we say we want to increase the, business savvy, or the, certain aspects, maybe more, collaboration. So you get into these general sort of characteristics of employees But it's like, so how do I measure that that actually did anything, for one? And how do I justify that I'm spending that money on things that are, that again, are very kind of general? And it's like, it's certainly not, they're not bad things, but I can't go back and say, you know what, we had a skills gap, and we had an option. We could have hired to fill that skills gap, or we could train to fill that skills gap. And sometimes, you know, hiring to fill that skills gap, you get limited because maybe you only have so many hires to give, or you don't want to, you know, riff or lay off a whole set of people to get the people you want. You've got budget constraints, or whatever those issues are, and maybe you've got a good team, you know, to begin with. You got the basic components. And so, you know, one of the things that I certainly would recommend is that you really need to tie it to your strategy. And a couple episodes ago, you know, we talked about some of the elements of a marketing strategy, and one of the internal focuses of executing that strategy there are three elements. There was the operating model, which is basically how you get the work done. There was what do we need to measure? So what are our goals? Contribution goals, brand improvement, project milestones. And then the other was capabilities. And capabilities gets you down to the typical people, process, and technology. But again, you know, we budget for technology. You know, we know that's, you know, 4 or 6 whatever percent of a marketing budget. We know data is, you know, probably a key piece of the marketing operations budget, so we can isolate that. But people, so what, you know, and we may say that you know, we've got our strategy is to improve our customer engagement. Okay, so what are some of the people skills we need to bring along with that? You know, do we need to upskill our, you know, telequalification team? Do we need to add training to be able to do the kind of analysis of what customer engagement is all about, or how well we're doing, which, you know, kind of goes across the marketing team? It's not just in the demand team. Yeah. You know, do we need to understand how marketing works better with sales to make sure that sales is, or we're supporting sales in engaging with a customer? Or in some cases, it might be another function, like are we helping with how services engages with the customer? So those may be things that you know, your people aren't currently doing well together, but with some really targeted enablement activities, you know, whether it's, you know, taking people through seminars or whatever, if you make that enablement more focused, for one, you can find something that you can benchmark at the end of the day. And you can justify it, because it's like, hey, we were set up, our marketing strategy to support the business strategy, that we had some dependencies for order for us to hit our goals. Those dependencies included some skills improvements, some people in the team. And so let's go forth and execute on that.
Right. So what I'm hearing there is, I mean, if we look at, say, like an OKR model or something like that, that maybe we're running against, is that it's key that we include upskilling our team as an objective for marketing, right? When we talk about skills and we talk about training, are we talking about training on specific platforms that we have, or are we talking about training on the things that we uniquely do, like who are our personas, what's our customer journey? Are we talking about sort of marketing fundamentals about, you know, the best practice in digital marketing, etc.?
I mean, I think, you know, it could be all those things, but again, I think the more you make it pointed to a particular gap in the organization, the better off. I mean, for one, the better you can justify it, the better you can justify the spend, the better you can communicate the reasons why you're actually asking people in the department to go through whatever that skills train is. And one of the things that makes this kind of hard to discuss is that it could be almost anything. You know, it could be, you know, maybe you're changing your operating model and you're going to more, you're going to be people more involved in Agile. Okay, so that's a very concrete thing you can train people on how to operate in Agile teams. Maybe I was actually talking to a guy yesterday who was like, you know, our boss wants us to, you know, build or require some technology to help us do more account-based marketing, but our team isn't there yet. Okay, so what does the team need to understand about account-based marketing that's different from their current job? And so I think that's, again, you know, making it more directed to fill the gap that you have gives it a better chance of success. And again, something that becomes easier to communicate what the value of asking your team to go through this. You're asking the team to go through this.
Yeah, I should explain a little bit of the noise there. Your microphone keeps moving, doesn't it? You have to keep adjusting it so I can see. I see that going. So we're talking. So there, you were talking about the sort of the operational model and the things that we need to be training people on. And I think I skipped the question where you said, "What do you do?" I'm like, "Yeah, you're quite right. I haven't. The only you know, training that I've seen has been on training in terms of a new employee comes in, what are our personas, what's our customer journey. I did an engagement with a smaller organization where they were looking for some sort of expertise of my kind of experience, but they didn't want that full time. So therefore I built out a plan for them, and then they hired a marketing director who would then implement the plan, right? Yep. So that they got the best of those. So that's one of the values of fractional CMOs, as an aside. But anyway, so what so from your perspective, what's your recommendation on what somebody like me should have done in those situations? I think in building this out,
I think you need to put somebody in charge of enablement. I know when I was working in the marketing ops strategy team at Serious Decisions, we often advocated that marketing ops is a good place to have that responsibility. And although, you know, it could be other places, you know, if you've got a chief of staff or, you could actually hire someone to be, you know, the head of market enablement, but there again, you got to have a higher, additional headcount for that. Yeah. The thing is that you don't want it to be the responsibility of human resources or some organization that does not really understand what marketing does. So I think the more you bring it in-house, and maybe if you have a good, I worked at a company, Kronos, that had excellent sales enablement team, but they just had a couple of people who were just really good at running enablement programs. Right. I'd have been perfectly happy to give the responsibility of marketing enablement to a team like that. Yeah. So one is, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's like quite often, don't we, especially in B2B tech firms, is if we're trying to teach the marketing team agile, we bring somebody in from product development that can help them with that, right? Yep. So it is pulling people from the other organization. But also, to your point about HR, what I've actually seen work quite well is if you create a skills matrix, if you try and create a job description and job levels and proficiency levels, and then a skills, I mean, it's a lot of fucking work, but nobody wants to do it. But if you create a skills matrix which says, okay, so you're a digital marketer level one or whatever you want to describe it as, right? And therefore we expect you to be proficient at this. I don't think you can really build an enablement plan unless you know what level two is and level three or what your expectations are, right? So I think there is a HR element to this, isn't it, that we need to do that stuff.
Yes, so I think partnering with HR would be essential.
Yeah.
Because they do have an interest in it. I just don't think that they do a very good job in terms of actually running it.
Oh, no, but they can
it.
Help us with the process, right? So,
And then if you build that enablement, and so you hire somebody, then you build kind of an enablement plan, and either you take... You take what you were discussing, which is, you know, we've got certain people at certain, proficiency levels, and we want to progress them up as part of a career advancement, or we take this more specific, I see a gap, you know, if you're going from this current fiscal year to next current fiscal year, I have a gap I need to fix. So there are two different ways you can approach the enablement plan, or you could do both. Yeah. And then, you know, put some budget towards it. You know, if you took 2 or 3% of your marketing budget and put it towards enablement, I think you'd get lots of rewards. Because again, as I said, you know, typically, you know, an organization puts 45% of their overall marketing budget to people. Yeah. So, you know, why not, you know, take a slice out of that and put it to training, or take a slice out of your program budget, you take a slice out of your budget to put technology. So why aren't the people that are using the technology as important as an investment?
Well, I mean, you could build the business case against retention, right? It's 45% of your budget is people. how much of that 45% is recruitment costs.
And the expense of hiring, the expense and time of hiring somebody new, the hiring process, bringing them on board, you know, all the onboarding training to get them up to speed. It takes a year before they get to be really productive. It's like, you could get ahead of the game with somebody you've already got on staff and train them to help fill that gap.
Yeah, I mean, back to talking about why there's the challenge. I think it's cultural, isn't it? I mean, I was thinking about my own marketing career while you were chatting there, and also if you look behind me, I've got all these marketing books. And if I think about some of the marketing training people on my team have done, or people I've worked with before, it's been driven by themselves, right?
Yes, so, absolutely.
I was working with somebody who was doing Mark Ritson's mini MBA. You know, that wasn't something that the organization had promoted. It's just that they did it themselves. And most people that I like to work with like to read marketing books and get up to speed with his latest thing. So yeah, it's always been on us, hasn't it?
It has.
So anyway, if we're not going to put it on our people and we're going to do some of these recommendations, how do we then measure the success of that? How do we then, because we're always talking about measurement, aren't we, in marketing?
We are. Yes, we like measuring things. and if we're in sales, we don't want to be measured until we get paid. Yeah. So I think there's lots of ways you can do this. And I kind of go back to some of my old books on change management. So, you know, what was the participation in the training? What's our progress on project milestones? I mean, if we were doing this to help us get to a certain, proficiency in terms of executing campaigns or building our website or whatever it is, are we executing better than we were in the past? What's the satisfaction of our stakeholders of marketing? Because I think that's a big one. It's like if sales doesn't have a good opinion of marketing, or product doesn't have a good opinion of marketing, and part of what we should be doing with our upskilling is making sure they start having a better opinion of us.
Well, some of the upskilling is those soft skills, isn't it? It's skills of management. It's a skill, you know, it's not just going to be about how to run the best PPC campaign in the world. It's going to be about how you manage people and how you manage colleagues. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
And then also, it's always just important employee engagement, employee satisfaction, mm-hmm. employee attrition. If you're losing people, and they're the wrong people to lose, then there's something's going wrong. Yeah. The ability to improve retention and people's job satisfaction is not always about, and rarely is about, just getting paid. Mm-hmm. It's about, do I feel like I'm contributing? Do I feel like I'm performing well myself? Am I learning things myself? And so, we don't want to, and I think one of the things we mentioned from that study a couple of weeks ago was that people felt that they were sort of pigeonholed, or they were stuck in kind of siloed activity, and that's no way to grow in a marketing department. Yeah. So, not everybody wants to grow up to be the CMO, but it's like usually you do want to, see that I'm progressing through my career and getting up to either senior levels of managing people, or getting into a role where you're providing a more more prominent individual contributor role.
Yeah, no, that's splendid. Yeah, so it's definitely, I mean, it's a great topic, isn't it? I mean, maybe we should have some sort of research director do some research on this or something like that. I don't know if we know anybody like that. But anyway, so that's brilliant. Thank you very much.
Are you pointing me to do that?
And the last, it sounds like the market needs it, mate. So it'd be for the world. Last item on the agenda, what's the song for this week?
Well, it's got to be about learning. So I came upon Learning to Fly from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, 1991. Classic song, and I think the title says it. You want to be learning to fly.
I love it. Yes, an absolute classic from the early 90s. Perfect. All right, then. Thank you very much, Jeff. And when this goes out, you'll be enjoying your holiday. So hope you're enjoying your holiday.
That's right. And then I'll be seeing you next week.
And I'll see you next week. Yeah, thank you very much, Jeff. And I'll see you then, mate.
Cheers.
Cheers, brother. The good old days.
may not return.
And the rocks might melt. Thank you, Jeff. That was, of course, the 90s classic Learning to Fly by Tom Petty from 1991. Great topic, developing our teams. Really interested in your perspective. Let us know. You can contact the show at hello@rockstarcmo.com. Speaking of contacting the show, it's time to welcome a friend of the show and guest from episode 55, Irene Naircon-Kane. If you're a frequent listener, you'll have heard of Irene, as we often mention her as she sends us suggestions and feedback. But what you may not know is that Düsseldorf-based Irene is a dynamic, creative and goal-oriented international marketing professional with over 15 years of management leadership experience in business development, marketing and communications. Irene's particular expertise is B2B marketing, working with mid-market international matrix organisations and tech startups, where she combines strategic planning and thought leadership with decisive execution to drive growth and competitive advantage. Irene has recently written a couple of straight-talking articles on the trouble with CMOs for our Marketing Street Knowledge blog, and I thought I'd grab the opportunity to ask her about that. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Welcome back, Irene, to Rockstar CMO FM. How are you?
Good. Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me back. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, you're very welcome. We talk about you a lot on the show, as you know. You're a friend of the show. You make a lot of suggestions to us. You get a lot of feedback from you on the social media. So it's splendid to have to be speaking to you live, as it were. We first chatted, I think, on episode 55. But for people that haven't heard us mention Irene regularly on the show or didn't listen to episode 55, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Okay, I'm Irene. I've been living and working in Düsseldorf, Germany for more than 20 years. I studied marketing and business administration, and I have been in the B2B business for almost all my life. So I've worked in mid-marketing companies, international matrix organizations, startups as well, in different industries, advertising and media, finance, CRM and contact center business. There, I worked as a head of marketing and PR for the Dutch, German, and Eastern European market. Weird combination, but that aside, at that stage of my career, I learned everything about the importance of customer service. And finally, for the last 5 years, I've been working in the software industry here, software as a service for BI and analytics, marketing tech, and last but not least, HR tech. Yeah. So I would say I'm a B2B marketing professional with heart and soul.
And having talked to you and spent time with you, I can agree with that. And I would encourage listeners to go back to episode 55 and learn a bit more about your story. But the reason for having you on the show this week is you've written a couple of guest blog posts for us with the splendid title of The Trouble with CMOs, which we split across two articles, a huge topic. So why don't we start with your first article? And also, like, maybe I should ask you, what inspired you to write these articles in the first place?
Okay, sure. the article comes from personal experience, so to say. So during my career, I've experienced that there's often a mismatch between the importance of our role as a CMO and the decision-making authority we've been given. On the one hand, we are the brand advocates, the customer advocates, we are being accountable for sustainable growth. But on the other hand, we lack the respective decision-making power to execute our strategies, our campaigns, which we think are suitable to reach the business targets. And to my personal view, it's not a good fit at all. Mm-hmm. And by the way, when I speak of CMOs, I mean the top marketing executive company. So we have several applications for CMOs. So.
Yeah. And your first article, you suggest that we jailbreak out of the assumptions of marketing. You particularly talk about the CEO there. So what are you saying about those generally held assumptions of marketing? Tell us about that. What are we saying?
Yeah, okay. So I didn't want to tell only my story. So I researched for some empirical evidence. And what I found is that it is a kind of standard experience for all CMOs that they're facing. Yeah. They have the shortest tenure in the C-suite, and it often stems from mismanagement of mutual expectation. That is, CEOs do not clearly set their expectations, if at all. Mm-hmm. But irrespective of what the CMOs or CEO says, I think it's important that we know what we want from our position. And it is crucial that CMOs have guts to demand respect for their expertise.
Yeah,
I definitely think that, yeah. So yeah. And that goes along with the respective decision-making authority. CMOs should do that, say that from the very first beginning of a conversation they enter with the CEO or with the company. And if they don't do that, if they don't express their own expectation, they might end up in endless justification rounds, which is neither pleasant nor purposeful. Yeah. And the intent for the article was somehow I had to digest my own experiences, to be honest. And on the other hand, I wanted to encourage CMOs to be bold. And
So the way that you're just expressing that just now is that it sounds to me like if you're going for a senior marketing position, some of these assumptions and some of this understanding of what the CEO or the C-suite needs to be established before you even take the job, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
It's easy to think. Imagine a CEO has studied somewhere or has made his own experiences or her experience. The CFO has studied and he knows how to deal with balance sheets. Yeah. And we, as marketers, we know how to deal with brand, with customer expectations and lead gen. Yeah. So we do not need a CFO or a CEO to tell us how to do our job. And that, I think, is very important. And that is, I think, implied in the word respect for our profession.
Yeah. And I think that comes across well in that second article, because you title that one, "Trust Me, I'm a CMO." And you use the analogy of a chef. So why do you think CMOs should be treated like chefs?
Yeah, just let me explain the example. If restaurant owners hire a new chef, they do it based on experience or the reputation the chef has in market. And the restaurant owner does not pretend that she can cook. She simply gives the direction of the kitchen, whether it's a French cuisine or Italian style. None of that matters. But then she employs and trusts her chef. And the customers are finally those who rate the dishes. And that is a proven concept, right?
Yes.
However, CEOs or the C-suite, they often think they can cook better than us. So they question whatever we do in marketing strategy, campaigns, and initiatives. And I think this is a picture that perfectly illustrates the situation. I assume a restaurant owner would not pretend she cooks better than her chef. She just trusts her. And that is what I expect from CEOs throughout the world or the C-suite as well. Let me cook and let the customers decide.
Yeah. And I like that way you were saying, you talked about would the owner of the restaurant tell you how to boil your pasta, right?
Of course he wouldn't. So it's up to the chef to cook the dish.
I love this. I love this analogy because the way that I think it works really well as an analogy is that all of us can cook, but a chef has, you know, you would trust a chef. And the thing is the typical thing about marketing is everybody's got an opinion about marketing, right? The CEO, the C-suite, you know, even the developers, right? But our role isn't as trusted, is it? We have to listen to all these opinions. And sometimes if it's the CEO telling you what to do, then they become, you know, they want to drive what you're doing as a marketing team, right? I like that. And then
it's a bit of a pity, and in a difficult situation here.
Yeah, exactly. But I really like that analogy of a chef. I'm going to use that. I'm going to steal that. And in that second article, you also cite 5 CEO no-gos for working with a CMO. Do you want to talk about those?
Yeah, of course. Okay. So the first, and I think the most important thing for me, at least, is clear no-go is micromanagement.
Yeah.
I don't want to justify each and every step I'm doing. So to my view, this is a clear sign of distrust. Yeah. And that's no environment where I can thrive, to be honest.
Yeah.
Second is maybe we have account-based marketing or sales enablement. Oh, Jan, I've left school. Let me do my job, okay? I can't believe that somebody is telling me that, yeah? Yeah, the next thing is insisting on talking customer. I think it's a good point. Do I really have to check each and every step a user does on the web? We have learned customers rather feel uncomfortable in the meantime when we do that. Mm-hmm. I've worked for a MarTech company which did attribution, but today I have to say I'd rather prefer to return to contextual targeting. That's my opinion here.
Yeah.
And we have another point which is might be kind of tricky. Yeah. So on the one hand, marketers have short-term goals and we have to deliver based on quarters. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, we have long-term goals. Mm-hmm. But I think CEOs that pretend they have patience and on the other hand, expect that we come with huge lead gen or whatever results within one quarter, I think that's not okay. Yeah. So because we have to do both. Yeah. On the one hand, we have to look out for brand. On the other hand, we have to look out for lead gen. And sometimes things work out well, and sometimes we have to adjust campaigns, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we live and learn.
Yeah.
And finally, of course. Yeah. So, and finally, we have we're always considered as cost centers, yeah, mm-hmm. and we have to justify our marketing dollars. And I think that it's we should be taken as an investment. So, and I think even startups, they go to venture capitalists and they say, okay, you have to invest in our company because we are good. So, if no risk, no fun. And I think the important thing here is our strategies, our marketing strategies. Yeah. They derive from the overall company strategy, so they make sense.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah. And that came through. that came through in your article because I that there isn't a distinction, is there? We shouldn't be needing to earn our marketing dollars. Our marketing dollars should be part of the strategic investment in the company's growth, right? It just should naturally come through. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So I like those five, and we love a list on Rockstar CMO, as you know, because you listen to the show. So so we've got in the first one, the CEO no-goes, which is insisting on stalking customers, micromanaging number two, asking for things that are so obvious to us as marketers, like ABM. I love the fact that I love your comment of I've not just come from school, pretending to play the long game but expecting 90-day results, and then making us earn the marketing dollars, which I think is great. So there's a really good five there. And then and then you move on to another point that I really liked, and you're saying that there's a lot of dogma, a lot of advice to marketers at the moment about selling our ideas and to change our language in the C-suite. I mean, I just read a chapter of a marketing book that referred to a few different case studies of other CMOs saying they've basically dropped the word branding from their language in the C-suite because they don't think the CEO understands branding or the value of branding, and they just renamed what they're doing in order to sort of get their point across or get their budget. But you're saying the opposite. You think that actually we should express ourselves in marketing terms. Tell us about that.
Yeah, to me, it does not sound really like communication at eye level. If I'm not allowed to use a word which is really common for marketers. We all know that branding is so important for sustainable success. Yeah. And we have been given evidence by a recent study, by the way, from the B2B Marketing Institute, I remember where you referred to the study in your podcast, number 119.
Wow.
Yeah. But just for curiosity, may I ask what we should say instead of branding to be well heard by the C-suite? Is there any suggestion?
Well, the thing is, they were just talking about things like growth marketing and any. I'll have to find the chapter in the book and what. And so they were basically just talking about anything but branding. And so they were talking about the outcomes from branding more than just talking about branding, which there is. I think there's a value in talking about the outcomes, absolutely, but I think that. And I wrote an article about this recently on the blog as well, is that I think we need to express that branding is a multiplier of all the other marketing things that we do. So if nowadays most B2B tech CEOs in particular understand the pay-per-click and the coin-operated marketing that we do, right? But that, what they need to understand is the branding thing, which is harder to measure, has an impact on all those things that are easier to measure. Do you see it? So your PPC improves if your branding's better. So I think some of the conversation about whether we should talk about branding to the C-suite is more about how do we express this in turn. Mm-hmm. But I think your point is correct as well, because it's almost patronizing, isn't it, that a CEO is not going to understand the value of some of the marketing terms and concepts that we talk about.
Yeah, and I think you should teach them.
Yeah,
they should be open-minded to us, or to our language. So I don't say, may I suggest that CFO avoid the word balance sheet, although it's a very common and important word, and the balance sheet itself is very important for the investment, whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't ask them to kind of use another language so that I understand their wording or their impetus. Perhaps my viewpoint sounds a bit provocative, but I think as always in communication, it boils down to how and not to so much to the what. And of course, a CEO can ask me what I tend to achieve with my marketing initiatives. And as an attentive listener, she or he could question why I think this or that initiative would be the right approach to achieve a set goal. I don't want to avoid discussion here. But what I've also experienced is the other way, so that CEOs have their performed opinion on what's right or wrong. And to my view, they miss the opportunity to learn something, to learn something new and maybe insightful about how to attract their specific market. And I think the CMOs are the professionals here.
Absolutely. And I also think that what just popped into my mind with you saying that, I think it is exactly as you're expressing, which is about respect and communication and finding that right level. But also sometimes with a CEO, I think it's called managing by the magazine you get on an aeroplane, right, is that a CEO will hear about a term like ABM, or they'll hear about a channel like TikTok, and they'll say, what are we doing about this, right? And you'll find yourself being managed by the latest buzzy article your CEO has just read, right? Or somebody's just mentioned to them down the golf club. So it's that, isn't it?
Definitely it's that. Okay, we can discuss, of course we can take that up and we can discuss that and we can argue and we can explain why we don't think TikTok is the right opportunity for us as a business, then it has to be accepted by it, because we are the
professionals. I mean, it all boils back. I mean this chef analogy you've made is just so perfect for this, isn't it? Because, and I think, you know, we are talking about the fact that the CMO's marketing recipe and methods shouldn't be the thing that's trusted. What should be trusted is the taste, right, and the output and the results of what you've created, I think. And the other and going back to a point I made a little while ago, which was about what one should do if you're going for a senior marketing role. And I like that you also make this point about cultural fit and cultural ad. What did you find there when you did some research around this about what's the difference between cultural fit and cultural ad?
Yeah, I think there's a big difference between cultural fit and cultural ad, and we should be careful here. If a CEO, what I interpret, if a CEO looks for a cultural fit, I think it's rather assumed that the CMO assimilates to the way the company works. Right. Maybe Like in your example, avoids the word branding and replace it by whatever KPI. But if a CEO or a company is looking for a cultural ad, she accepts new viewpoints, diversity, or even a specific language to learn. And that implies that there is a C-suite that is open to new insights from outside. So as a CMO is invited to present her ideas, viewpoints, and messages in her own words or his own words. And I think that's an environment which I would prefer, and CMO definitely should look out to.
I really like this. There's a lot of advice here in your articles about when somebody is going for a new role, the sorts of things to look out for and to be aware of the kind of environment you're going to end up working in, right? Is asking some of these questions and looking at some of these things.
Yeah, I think the cultural fit or the cultural ad or the cultural environment, I think that is the very important thing for me, at least, which I'm looking for when I'm looking for a new position. I'm not looking for a certain title or a certain amount of money. That's somehow important, but cultural situation and am I respected? Is the C-suite interested in my point of views? And is there a lively discussion? I don't want to avoid any discussion here, but at some stage, the argument of the CMO should count. Or maybe you can convince me that sometimes he or she is better, but we have to have a discussion at eye level. That's very important.
I really enjoyed your articles. Thank you very much. And you're always. Some of your feedback about the show was that we should stick to time. I really enjoy your feedback.
Okay, we have to do that as well, right?
I always enjoy your feedback. Thank you very much. But when if folks want to get in touch with you, Irene, and they spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you?
They find me on LinkedIn.
All right.
The easiest way. I have a Twitter account, but I think LinkedIn is the best way to get in touch with me.
Splendid. Well, I'll include all your links in the show notes, Irene. It's been an absolute pleasure catching up with you again, and I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Thank you so much, dear.
Cheers, Irene. Bye-bye. Thank you, Irene. Some straight talking there. What do you think? I'd encourage you to take a look at her articles too. She quotes from a bunch of great sources, and you can find those on rockstarcfo.com. Just click on the Marketing Street Knowledge link. Right, it's the end of the week, time to wind down. And where better than the Rockstar CMO Virtual Bar, where I find my friend and content marketing guru, Robert Rose, Chief Trollmaker at the Content Advisory, for a cocktail and a marketing thought. Good evening, Robert. What are you drinking?
Oh, wow. Holy smokes. I'm so glad you're in the bar, but there is a full-on football game going on here. It's the loudest I've ever heard it in the bar. Oh, listen to the chant. Is that a Man U chant I hear?
Not in this bar. Yeah.
Oh, I thought I'd get you with that one. Yeah, I think that is a Man U chant that I'm hearing. You've really opened your mind. You've really, really opened your mind, my friend, because I can't believe you've let them in here. But here we are.
I was just going to ask you which kind of football, and you've made it clear that it's the soccer kind.
It's the real kind of football, isn't it? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I bring that up only because, of course, Elon Musk was going to buy Man U and then decided in a tweet that he wasn't going to buy Man U anymore. But boy, it's loud in here.
Jolly funny, that boy, isn't he?
Yes.
Elon Musk.
He is.
Anyway, yes. Well, you know, I've got to make ends meet. I'll let anybody in the bar.
Yeah, I guess you did charge them rent. Yes, that is the selling tickets. Well,
if these Northerners could just chill out for a bit, then let's have a conversation.
That's
right. What are we going to be drinking?
We're going to be drinking this week something I'm calling a Boston Sour. And of course, you know a good whiskey sour when you taste one. And a whiskey sour for your audience is just a very simple whiskey and usually bourbon, to be honest. And then, of course, a little lemon juice. I like a little maple syrup in a whiskey sour to sort of sweeten things up a little bit. And then that's usually your whiskey sour. It's a very simple drink to make. But we're going to mix it up. And what we do is we put a little bit of egg white in there. And that's, you know, you froth that up a little bit, you know, so you mix in the egg white, froth that up a little bit into it. It makes a lovely looking drink and also very tasty, a very, very tasty, very sweet, and a lovely drink to end the week on in a dark bar somewhere.
Lovely. I think I've made one of your whiskey sours once. From one of your recommendations, and you're just you're using whiskey and all the right ingredients. You're not swapping in tequila or anything.
No, just a normal whiskey. I've been big into bourbon of late. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I love a bit of bourbon. Although, so as usual, every week I am going to attempt to make that using the ingredients on my desktop bar. As you heard, I've started with some ice, which I assumed we would do that for a nice whiskey sour. And the whiskey of choice I'm going to use is, as it turns out, Scotland's best, finest. I can't say that, can I? I can't say that Hendrick's gin is a Scottish version of whiskey. for anybody who listens on every week, you'll know the joke there. So I'm going to put in some some gin.
Yes. Is this the classic Scottish gin that we've been?
Yes. Okay, the Hendrix, which I only discovered last week, was Scottish, and the sourness in my particular drink is going to come from the cucumber that the fine people of Fever Tree.
Maybe you could put a pickle in there, and that would sour things up a little bit.
Oh, you know the that time when I made a martini and you were absolutely disgusted by the fact there was an anchovy inside my olive.
That was
a really dirty, filthy martini.
It's disturbing. Disturbing on many levels.
Let me try this whiskey sour. Let's see. That is delicious, Robert. I could drink one of these every week. What are we calling this?
We're calling that a Boston Sour, and you'll find out why in just a moment. But yes, that is a Boston Sour, not just a whiskey sour.
Very refreshing. I'm not getting a lot of sourness, I must admit.
You know, that'll happen when you put gin and cucumbers together.
It's delicious. And where are we going to be drinking these?
We're going to go to Boston. There, yeah, and again, we'll find out why. We're going to go to Boston, which is one of my favorite cities in the world.
Yep.
And great as we get back to school and all of those kinds of things, because it's just, you know, it's a city known for its universities and we'll find some wonderful little bar somewhere along the river to sit and have our Boston Sours.
Love it. I think, did we meet in Boston at like Gil Bain?
We may have. We may have indeed met in Boston.
Or New York, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, at one of those Westin hotels there, I think.
Yes. About 20 years ago. Oh, I don't know. We don't want to think about it.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. It's a long, long time ago.
Back when our forefathers were running the city, probably.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so we're in Boston, and where we've been before, and we've talked about marketing in Boston before. In which direction is the conversation going to take?
We're going to go to a key strategy question, and it's really sort of a existential question of what is strategy, because when recently I've been talking a lot, I've been writing a lot about this and been talking about this on webinars and in my workshops, where I say something that finally got a response that I had thought would come earlier, but didn't, I say a lot that, you know, basically in a content strategy, it does not have anything, you know, your differentiation and competitive advantage has nothing to do with the content, but rather the content strategy and operations that you put together. That's, you know, in other words, you will not differentiate yourself using content, but if you put in a smart content strategy, you just might. And I said it on a webinar recently, and a CMO emailed me, and we ended up having a lovely phone conversation, and he asked if he could push back a little bit on that, on a word. And I said, of course, sure, push away. And he said, how is a content strategy provide competitive advantage if the content itself does not? Doesn't the strategy support define the content? In other words, isn't a content strategy defining what content we want to produce? And if the content doesn't actually provide the differentiation, what the heck is the strategy? And I said, well, that's great. First of all, let's go get a Boston Sour and sit down on the river. and the funny thing is that, you know, the reason I come to that, and it sort of goes back to my classic education, and I go all the way back to Michael Porter, who, of course, was a professor at the Harvard Business School, which is why we find ourselves in Boston right now. And he wrote an amazing article, which we could even link to in the show notes. It's called What is Strategy? And he wrote this about 25 years ago. And he basically, it's way too long of a post to sort of summarize here, but ostensibly he said that a strategy, when we think of strategy, what is it? It's the fit of the activities that work together in a business. So as he said, like the activities that we do, ultimately all the difference between any company, they all derive from the hundreds of activities required to run that business. So then he said, thus, activities are the basic unit of competitive advantage. In other words, how you do those activities. And then he said, but interestingly, it's not about doing them efficiently. In other words, what he called operational effectiveness. In other words, he said, if you're focused on activities on operational effectiveness, that's basically performing similar activities as your competitor, but just doing them better, right? Just doing them more efficiently.
Right.
He said differentiation comes from doing different activities or performing those same activities in a different way. And I love that because that really helps me understand the core of a great content strategy. So a great content strategy is basically around developing all of the activities around content that help us communicate in a more effective way. And so our challenge for the competitive advantage then is to do all of those things, all of the activities around a content strategy, but find ways to do them differently. So to the CMO that I had, you know, on the call, when he said, well, what's a content strategy? And I said, well, just go read what Michael Porter said. and I said, no, I'm kidding. I'm not going to make you go read all that. But the way I defined it was a great content strategy is the coordination of all the activities required to enable a business to communicate effectively. And that, to me, works really well as the definition of a content strategy. So a content strategy is that, not that the brand will talk about X, Y, or Z, right? So a content strategy is all the activities and making sure they fit together and doing that in a way that helps the business evolve its communication in the most frequent way possible, no matter what you decide to talk about on any given day. And that basically then gets to the fact of, okay, well, how do we then make that a competitive differentiator over time? Well, it means changing the activities. It means changing the way that we do AI activities, because what I find so many times in businesses is that what we've done with content is basically shape all those activities based on how it fits the marketing needs it on any given day. In other words, we run campaigns and we, you know, the executives need a PowerPoint and, you know, basically content becomes a service. The activity becomes a service to fitting into marketing activities rather than what I see successful companies doing is the other way around. In other words, they figure out the right function of creating great communication, great content, and then fit marketing activities around that.
Right.
And that really, to me, says what today's true evolved modern marketing strategy is a way to fit in content strategy to what the activities of marketing are. And I think that is at the heart of a great, you know, if people can indulge me, I think that means that getting our content right is actually the first step in getting our marketing right. And that, to me, is what we're looking at in a modern strategy.
Yeah. And I like that, because I like the idea there that the quality of your execution is a differentiator, because it might be that a competitor is saying broadly the same things. I mean, you know, I hang out in B2B marketing most of the time, and you see in a lot of categories. In fact, most B2B websites are fairly similar. They talk about their features, and, you know, you could copy and paste most of their navigation structures onto one to the other, and you wouldn't notice, right? But I think what I like there is that even if you're in a category where you need to tell a very similar story to a competitor, the quality of your execution, because you've got that well-built machine behind it, and the fact you're going to be consistent, and the fact that you understand your audience, so therefore you're going to be relevant, you're going to do all those things just that tiny bit better than your competitor, and that's going to be the differentiator. Is that what you're saying?
That's it, right? You know, basically, what most businesses don't understand are all of the activities that need to be performed to create differentiation with content. In other words, the classic example of this is how we think of differentiating with content, which is, let's think of some really cool, creative, interesting idea, and let's just go execute against that project, and which doesn't give us scale. And it doesn't give us differentiation. Now, we might for a small moment in time come up with something truly unique, right? We might come up with something that goes viral, or we might come up with something that truly differentiates us for about 5 minutes. But the immediate thing that happens is that all of those ideas are transitory in nature, because someone can immediately come along and say exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And so in other words, we'll either be so successful that everybody copies us, or we've already copied somebody else. And so the only thing that allows us to truly have competitive advantage over time is our ability to evolve. So Rita Gunter McGrath, who is an amazing thought leader on this topic of competitive advantage, and wrote a whole book called The End of Competitive Advantage, talked about the transitory nature of competitive advantage. And she called them arenas. And she said, truly, the strategic business value today is how quickly we can move in and out of arenas. And so that's where we get the competitive advantage. So a great content strategy is then how quickly can we as a business evolve in and out of the things that work? In other words, how quickly can we kill our website and get a resource center going? Or how quickly can we, you know, modify our social media strategy to adjust to the fact that organic reach is dead? And how quickly or rapidly or effectively can we move our activities so that we shift into building blogs or building, you know, hubs or doing the things that we need to do that actually, you know, are working in the moment? That's the competitive advantage that we can create, is how quickly we can evolve the activities we're doing, not what content or where we distribute them. That will always be transitory in nature.
Yeah. And becoming part of a new conversation.
That's like right. Something that's exactly right.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. But also, I mean, to my boring point I was making earlier on is, I mean, I was doing some, I think I talked last week about personas and needs. I was doing some persona needs work, and you realize that actually, you know, you're in a crowded category. You can't veer too far away from what the needs are of your buying personas. You're going to have to address things like risk or security or whatever is the thing in your category that's most important, right? It's going to be that quality of execution, how you express that and get into the zeitgeist of some of these conversations that are happening around those topics, right?
That's it. That's right. It's the, you know, and some of it honestly is the boring activities, right? It is it is sort of the basic blocking and tackling. You know, we talked last week about communication and how communication was such an integral part of the making sure that sales and marketing when it comes to content is truly aligned and effective. And in many cases, it's exactly that. It's just how do we put, you know, to Michael Porter's point, how do we fit all these activities together that are happening at product? You know, it's a complicated comedy for sure, right? You know, so, you know, there's the legal and you know, sort of, you know, sort of compliance aspects of this. There's the marketing and brand aspects of this. There's the, you know, different silos of people who are creating content experiences for our customers aspects to this. There's the workflow and governance aspects to this. There's all the things that we would associate with how to communicate consistently, effectively as a business. And all those activities in most businesses where it's dysfunctional are because the activities don't fit together very well. You know, everybody's got sort of their own way of doing things. And where strategy really works is when those activities really true work like an interlocking set of gears. And that's what we're looking for is that interlocking set of gears, but also one that can change quickly as it needs to.
Yeah, I love this. And the fact that you do that hard work, right? I mean, you know, I've known organizations where you had a very senior person that to approve all the content, therefore it completely broke the content machine. But if you can then solve that problem, that can help you then to get that agility that you were just talking about, isn't it? So if you get these processes and sort of grease each of these squeaky wheels and all this friction along the way, you'll build a machine that isn't necessarily what you're talking about, is how you're executing that becomes
the
differentiator.
That's right.
That's fascinating. Well, that's excellent. Thank you very much, Robert. And if people are looking at an example of a well-oiled content machine, where might they find one of those?
Well, they won't find anything that I run. If you're looking for well-oiled. But if you're looking for more content like this, you'll find it on our website at contentadvisory.net.
Splendid. And when people spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you, Robert?
They'll find me a lot these days on LinkedIn, that's for sure. Would love to connect with everybody there. And then there's also, of course, our little community called experienceadvisors.io. Nice. And for anybody who's out there creating customer experiences or content-driven experiences for customers or audiences, would love to have you come over and apply for membership. We've got a thriving little community over there, and we're having some nice talks.
Yes, we have. And I forgot to mention it last week, although it's always in the show notes, so people have been able to find it there. So experienceadvisors.io. And most importantly for me, as a selfish person that I am, will I find you in the bar next week?
You will indeed, and I'm hoping the man you folks will have exited the building by that point, yes.
They're all barred. You brought them in. Yeah. All right, mate. I'll see you next week. Cheers. Thank you, Robert. So we can differentiate by just being better at content marketing, not just by being different. I love that. So that's a wrap on episode 129 of the Rockstar CMO FAing Marketing Podcast. I've been your host, Ian Truscott. Thanks again to Jeff, Irene and Robert for sharing their insight. Please say hello to them. I'll include all their links in the show notes, which you can find on your favorite podcast app or rockstarcmo.com, where you can also find all our previous episodes. But most of all, thank you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track and jiving along with us. So, does the world need another effing marketing podcast? Please let us know on the socials or drop a rating or review in your favourite podcast app. Or just keep listening. I'm glad you're here. Next week, Jeff is back in the marketing studio. I go backstage with fellow podcaster and startup marketing specialist Seth Goldstein. And Robert will be back in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar. Until then, have a great week. And I hope you again join us here next week on Rockstar CMO FM.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.